Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington, D.C.
In Uganda, 2025 is a year for different political parties to choose those who will be holding the flags in the 2026 general elections.
A Ugandan member of parliament expects changes in the political landscape ahead of next year's general election.
You see, we do have a lot of problems in Cameroon, like many other African countries. And wherever there's humanity or human beings, there are problems, especially problems of human rights.
Cameroonian President Paul Biya promises to resolve the challenges facing the country.
And Malawians are saying that this cabinet, which he has constituted, is not really going to make the difference that Malawians are expecting.
And Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera announces a mini-cabinet reshuffle in his New Year address. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Uganda, a member of parliament says he is expecting changes in the political landscape this year ahead of next year's general election. David Kabanda also rejects criticisms that the legislature has willfully surrendered one of its core duties, financial appropriations, to the executive branch of government. It comes as opposition politicians and civil society leaders accuse parliament of failing to perform its oversight role as enshrined in the constitution, an allegation sharply denied by Kabanda. This as the Electoral Commission continues to compile a voter list for the presidential and legislative elections in 2026. For more on the expectations of parliament this year, I reached David Kabanda.
In Uganda, 2025 is a year for different political parties to choose those who will be holding the flags in the 2026 general elections, because we shall have the presidential and parliamentary elections in 2026 in the month of January. So 2025 is a very difficult year for all the politicians in Uganda, not only MPs, but also for the local leaders. So in parliament here, we are looking forward to many changes, including because we are expecting some guidelines from either government or the opposition side. Recently, the Honorable Mathias Mpuuga promised to bring some amendments in the electoral reforms. So we are looking forward to receiving some amendments in the electoral reforms. If they don't come, we shall continue with the rules and regulations that we already have in place.
Some people are suggesting that this year, parliament might not necessarily be that effective like in previous years, because people are getting ready to compete in their primary elections in order to be retained as parliamentary candidate for their respective parties, or even if they want to decide to go independent. What's your take on that?
It is not necessarily that parliament may not be so much active. No, because you must have been following all the parliaments in Africa. Even when there are no elections, parliaments in Africa are never full. You find a parliament like that one of Uganda, which has almost 500 MPs, in every sitting you only find not more than 200 or 250 MPs. So MPs, I think, will be alternating. Today you have so-and-so, tomorrow you may be having another person. We shall continue with the business, but I don't think that there shall be that much activeness in the House.
What do you say to critics of the National Assembly or Parliament who say that parliamentarians do not fight for the protection or respect of human rights of Ugandans as much as they would wish they would? How do you respond to them?
I absolutely disagree with whoever says that the MPs have not fought for the human rights of Ugandans. The other day, we have a newly appointed minister for the young people called Honorable Barambaro Gahara. During his vetting, he promised to engage the president to make sure that all the political prisoners be released. When he had just started on that responsibility, the members of the opposition themselves came out to oppose his good ideas, saying that they are populistic in nature and Baram should let the courts of law do their duty. Now, to them, they were not scoring because these people are going to get out of prison. It is this same parliament that Honorable Baram used to plead for those political prisoners.
What should be the expectations of Ugandans, of parliamentarians this year?
What should be expected from the parliamentarians and the parliament this year is to conclude with the manifesto for the government, because members of parliament, the president, promised many things when we're beginning this term, 2020, during elections. Now, we are concluding the term. How do you conclude the term? You have to go and give accountability to your people. What have you done for them? Because this is not a year that you're going to be working on most of government projects. No, this is a year of accountability. A few things you can achieve, well and good. But now we have to account to our people. For the past 4 years, what have we been doing to make sure that we achieve what we promised in 2020 during elections before we were voted into power?
David Kabanda is a Ugandan member of parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In Cameroon, President Paul Biya has promised a commitment to resolving the challenges facing the country. In his New Year message, the 92-year-old longtime leader also promised improved living conditions for citizens this year. Some analysts say the speech appears to be a move to signal Biya's plans to seek an eighth term in office. This as the Electoral Commission prepares to conduct the coming general election. The opposition Social Democratic Front, or SDF, says the president's promises are a repeat of previous promises of improved living conditions, which the government has yet to keep. Richard Indifo is the SDF's Secretary for Political Education and Training. He tells me that Cameroonians are demanding an administration that keeps its promises of a better life.
That is what we call in French déjà vu. It is the same old tired stuff from the President Paul Biya. Every other year, he comes in to promise a lot of things that never, ever materialize. When you listen to the head of state, you get away with the impression that he was just regurgitating the same thing he said last year. As a matter of fact, last year, he mentioned that he was aware of the challenges and the difficulties that Cameroonians were going through. Unfortunately, the past year has been nothing short of immense suffering, especially ordinary Cameroonians have gone through a lot with skyrocketing prices, with unemployment rates still at its peak, with the crisis in the northwest and southwest and other parts of the country still very alive. We have not witnessed any change.
But he's talking about working together with determination to move forward with resolving security issues and ensuring the country remains peaceful. Isn't it part of an effort to resolve some of the Anglophone crisis?
Working together with who, Peter, if I may ask that question? He will always get people who align with his thought, who believe in his ideologies, and he will not want to open up to genuine dialogue. When it comes to the crisis in the Northwest and Southwest, the SDF has proposed a genuine dialogue where all the parties should come to the table, and without taboo, they should have a frank conversation. And we have called on the President of the Republic to allow those in the diaspora to come back home and sit down on the table.
What makes you think that the SDF proposal is the panacea to resolving the Anglophone crisis?
Yeah, the SDF proposal, I may not use the word panacea, but I will want to say that the SDF proposal aligns very much with that of international communities like the Commonwealth, like the African Union. All of these international bodies, institutions have called on BIA to open an all-inclusive, genuine dialogue in which there is no taboo topic on the table. But what you see President BIA does is that he calls what he calls a national dialogue. And you start asking yourself, you have the English-speaking Cameroonians complaining, and then you go call a national dialogue. And then you come to the English-speaking zone, and you handpick people that you're willing to talk with, and you set the agenda, and then you discuss, and you call that a dialogue. That is not the kind of dialogue the SDF is preaching. We are preaching a dialogue where the real people who have the concerns, who have the grievances, are called up to sit on the table. Because, Peter, whether you like it or not, this issue is an issue between the government of Cameroon and the English-speaking Cameroonians.
But the president, in his New Year's speech, called on stakeholders to show proof of maturity and responsibility to ensure that peace and stability prevail during the election process. Isn't this what Cameroonians expect from their president?
Those are words. I call them loud-sounding words that have no real meaning in it. Because when he talks of stakeholders, who is he referring to as stakeholders? He's one of those stakeholders, and in fact, the most important stakeholder for that matter. He is the one who can order and ask that we sit on the table with these people who are complaining. He is the person who can determine all of this. And when he talks of stakeholders, the stakeholders in this crisis are the English-speaking Cameroonians who are fighting, who have expressed their grievances, and the government of Cameroon. And if we have to ask the international community to come in as mediators, these are the stakeholders in the crisis. Who else is a stakeholder? His speech is full of a lot of promises that do not really reflect on what Cameroonians are facing. And he has proven not to have the intention to address the crisis.
Richard Ndifo is the SDF Secretary for Political Education and Training. He spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. A human and education rights activist says Cameroonians expect a new year where the fundamental rights of citizens are respected by state institutions, including the security agencies. Nick Ngwanyam also says he expects the coming general election to bring significant changes in the lives of Cameroonians. His comments come as opposition groups accuse the police and gendarmes of abusing the rights of citizens, accusations they deny. For more about the expectations of Cameroonians in this new year, I reached Nick Ngwanyam in the commercial capital, Douala.
You see, we do have a lot of problems in Cameroon, like many other African countries. And wherever there's humanity or human beings, there are problems, especially problems of human rights. And I used to think that human rights was just a problem of Cameroon or African countries. But with the availability of social media, we are able to reach out to the whole world, and we realize that it's a basic human problem. And when you try to find out what is the understanding of human rights from different groups of persons, you realize that the perceptions are different.
What are your expectations for regarding state institutions' respect for the rights or the basic human rights of Cameroonians?
If you are talking about police and gendarme brutality, I can tell you that that is going to improve. Why so? Because, you know, the government is going to change in 2025. A lot of things are going to change. There will be elections coming, and we can only get better, will not get worse. And I can tell you that what is on the table now is going to change Cameroon in a very profound way and make things better for everybody. So to answer your question the way you want it, I will tell you that human rights would improve. We are going to improve our politics, we are going to improve our state institutions, we are going to improve our education, because, I mean, human rights abuses, sometimes if you look at it carefully, it boils down to lack of respect for basic values in the families, in the schools, the fact that the school systems probably don't teach respect for each other and the respect for state property, I mean, for common goods and so on.
You talked about the coming year things going to change. And what makes you so confident that things are going to change? Because some political analysts are telling me that President Paul Biya, who will be the presidential candidate for the governing CPDM, is going to win the election anyway. And they are predicting that if he wins, his policies are going to continue. So what makes you confident that things will change?
A lot is going to change because, as you know, things evolve. Nothing is stagnant. And one of the things that I can be certain about is that, President Paul Biya will win. Why would he win? He will win because the opposition is not organized, the opposition is greedy, and the opposition cannot choose a single candidate to represent them. So they are full of ego problems. So we have problems everywhere. You cannot replace the CPDM with another person who behaves like the CPDM. So while the CPDM is bad, we deal with the devil that we know. So that said, you know, what is going to change is that you can be certain that a new government will come in place. And when that new government comes, it's going to come with a new mindset, a new way of doing business, and a lot of things will change. You can take that for sure. I guarantee you that.
As a civil society leader, what has been the responses of people that you interact with about sometimes security officers beating up ordinary citizens for going about their duties, assembling and sometimes protesting, and they said their rights are violated because the Constitution guarantees them freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and so on?
Yeah, you are right. It's a real concern because, like you said, when I look at it, when you take just an individual case and look at it, you know, it looks, I mean, it's funny, but when you step back and look at the whole picture, then you begin to realize that it's a whole problem of human beings. You know, the gendarme who is beating up another person, you need to know from what family he comes and the kind of home training and the school or education he got. And when you stretch that beyond our boundaries, then I always remember how George Floyd was killed by policemen with his hands handcuffed with a knee on the neck. So that tells me that be they white or black, there is something wrong with people. We need to look at our politics and get it right. We need to look at our economics and get it right. We need to look at our development, especially the human development, and get it right. Then, of course, the development of physical structures and logistics, whatever. And then we need to tidy up our education.
Nick Ngwanyam is a human and education rights activist. He spoke with me from the Cameroonian commercial capital, Douala.
A famous author once wrote, "A vision without action is merely a dream. Action without vision just passes the time. A vision with action can change the world." As we begin a new year, let us come together on the next episode of Our Voices to explore the power of using a vision board to achieve our goals in 2025. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on the Voice of America.
Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera has announced a mini-cabinet reshuffle in his New Year address. The move, the president says, will bring renewed energy to his administration. In the new 31-member cabinet, Chakwera maintained Vice President Michael Usi, replaced the defense minister, added 7 deputy ministers, and split the Ministry of Education into 2, higher education and basic and secondary education. But critics say the increase in cabinet ministers will add to government spending. Chakwera's move, they added, appears to be in preparation for the coming presidential contest, where he's expected to face a stiff challenge from his main rival, former President Arthur Peter Mutharika. For analysis of the cabinet reshuffle, I read George Peary. He is a former lecturer at the University of Livingstonia in Malawi.
Malawians are saying that they will never be significant changes in performance, because the president is emphasizing on efficiencies and the performance of his cabinet. And Malawians are saying that this cabinet which he has constituted is not really going to make the difference that the Malawians are expecting, because the people who have been put in positions, there hasn't been significant change. He has just removed two cabinet ministers and replaced them with two. And some have just changed ministries from one ministry to another ministry. And this will not make significant difference from the performance of the previous cabinet that the president had.
Announcing his new cabinet, he said he wants to bring renewed energy in spite of the fact that the bulk of his core team was maintained.
My understanding is that I don't really know and understand what the president means. And that's why Malawi as a nation, we are having several challenges, because his government has not performed in a way that Malawians would have their major challenges resolved. I'm talking about this because when we talk about the food challenges that Malawi as a country is now facing, although he has very much talked about the cyclones, El Ninos, and so forth, but we had had the challenges even beginning with his first year in 2020-21 budget. And that year, we had very good rains across the country, but the government failed to supply the affordable input program, fertilizers and farm inputs, and the people failed to harvest better that year.
Talking about politics, the Vice President, Michael Usi, from the UTM, was maintained as a vice president, effectively joining the MCP, the ruling party, after he was expelled by his party, formed by former Vice President Saulos Chilima, who passed away in a plane crash last year. What do you make of this?
My understanding is that Usi has been maintained mainly because he supports the Malawi Congress Party, because the UTM, in fact, has expelled him now that the Malawi Congress Party's government has maintained the vice president. It is very clear that they have maintained him just for a period from now to the next elections. But thereafter, I don't see him anywhere in politics. Michael Usi has lost favor of the UTM, and Michael Usi has not formed his own party, and the future of Michael Usi is nowhere to be seen now, although the president has maintained him as the vice president, because constitutionally he's the one who has the prerogatives of appointing the vice president.
George Piri is a former lecturer at the University of Livingstonia in Malawi. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. In Zambia, new research details systematic challenges that hinder women's participation in politics, leading to their continued underrepresentation. The findings were contained in a study by the Southern African Institute for Policy and Research. Lead researcher Janet Mundandu called on women to move beyond peripheral political roles to run for electoral offices and take part in decision-making. This after expressing concern about women's representation in parliament, which stands at 15%, a drop from 17% in 2016. This, she adds, despite a legislative framework that includes the National Gender Policy created in 2014 and the Gender Equity and Equality Act introduced 1 year later. For more about the findings of the study, I reached lead researcher Janet Mundando.
I found that it is true that women are very underrepresented in Zambian parliament. The population of Zambia currently is at approximately 21,609,487. And of this population, 50.7% are women. And some literature says 51% are women, while ST 49.3% are men. So you can see that from this population, there are more women than men. But when it comes to the representation of women to key decision-making bodies, such as the National Assembly, these more women are lowly represented there, which is vice versa, which is an abnormality in itself. Because the more women are, the more representation they needed to have. But as at now, in the sitting 13th National Assembly in Zambia, we only have 15.1% women representation.
So in your research, what were some of the major factors that hinder women's representation in politics, especially or decision-making places in Zambia?
Okay, Peter, I'll tell you what, the Zambian society is highly patriarchal. And you know that patriarchy advocates that a woman is a stay-home person, a woman is a homemaker, a woman is supposed to take care of her husband, remain at home, clean the home, take care of the children, cook for the family, and that mentality is still high in the Zambian society. The number one cause for women underrepresentation here in Zambia is that political parties themselves, which are the entry points to, you know, electoral politics, are highly patriarchal. We have women on the political scene, but those are strong women who have really risen to try and navigate through patriarchy, to negotiate, power from patriarchy, to wrestle power from this patriarchal, society of Zambia. But again, we also see that the financial aspect is another serious hindrance to women's participation in politics. Another one is that whilst many of her peers are using gender quotas to try and revamp and try and increase women representation, Zambia has no any form of gender quotas to try and help women out.
But there are gender quotas in your constitution. What happens to the implementation of that law?
You know, Zambians are good at making all those policies. You know, we even have a gender policy in the nation. We even have the other legislatures supporting women representation in the political arena. But when it comes to implementation, it's a different aspect altogether. When I was talking to political parties, they told me, I requested, can you help me with the policy, the gender policy that you have? You know, they told me, no, we at the moment, we don't have a written, really specific gender policy, but the norm is that when you need to consider women, you need to have a percentage of women. So there's, you know, there is no implementation, and there's no body to follow up the implementation aspect of all these legislatures. Even the constitution itself, it simply mentions about, you know, gender equality. It doesn't stipulate punishments for not following what it states there.
We had two female vice presidents and several women representation in cabinet positions in Zambia. You don't think the mindset is gradually changing?
Well, there's been some improvement. Where we are coming from, it has been a worse situation. There's gradual improvement, but no, where we are by now, and in comparison to other countries, Zambia is faring very badly. At the moment, Zambia has the lowest, you know, representation of women in the region, in the sub-Saharan region.
Janet Mundando is lead researcher at the Southern African Institute for Policy and Research. She spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
time in Africa offers splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. From the classics of yesteryear to the hot tracks of the moment. I offer you what you need. Free ear therapy and mind massage. Join me, I'm Heather Maxwell, for Music Time in Africa every Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC.
The deputy spokesperson for the Sierra Leone police has denied media reports of alleged threat on the life of Thomas Dixon, a popular journalist. Bobson Senu also says it is important for media organizations to ensure they cross-check police-related information to ensure their reports are accurate. His remarks come after Dixon went into hiding over an alleged threat from the chief of police. The police chief denied issuing any threat to the journalist. Bobson Senu tells me that media organizations should stop tarnishing the image of the police and the country, both locally and internationally.
I've explained the entire issues, how the thing started, and where we are. So the media people, like me serving now as a PRO, I have no barriers to be contacted or meet with whatever things you want to. People are not even looking at the utterances of this man. People are now saying the threats. And besides being a journalist, you are not above the law. Equally so, being a police officer, I'm not above the law. We have this platform where if you have anything like I verify, you call. So, but this is the issue, like what you have done now. This is the issue. Why this is happening? Then if I fail to respond to you, or the IGP or whosoever fail to respond to you, you will now write based on the evidence or based on the thing you have at hand. But none of them did that to me. Only a few media houses. You understand? And other media houses are now even posting the concern about the threat of somebody else. But what about somebody else using obscene languages against another man's own father? Or another, put yourself in the position of that person. It was a simple discussion, right? As a journalist, it is your responsibility to weigh. You know, look at the two sides of the coin. You cross-check, use the ABC method. But this was never done in some of these issues. So that is the main reason.
But Bobson, some people are suggesting that the statement the police issued out concerning media credibility is neither here nor there, that if the police have any concerns about a media outlet that did not do its job well, then there's the Sierra Leone Journalists Association or there are media organizations that can address this. What say you?
The issue was addressed through the social media. So it was the same platform. We sent also that one through our official Facebook page. And become a worrisome because the journalists, sincerely speaking, they have the powers to make and not make. And if you are not cross-checking, fast-checking the fact of issue, just one side there, you put something, it send a negative signal. It become worrisome to some of to other people outside who are outside Sierra Leone, who are not residing in Sierra Leone, of which it is not the same. There are people are saying the man has even moved from his residence or whatever. All this is fake.
Are you saying it is fake when a journalist says that his life is being threatened based on certain pronouncement made by a top official of the police service?
But are you also concerned about the utterance made by the man against this other man in question?
I'm just asking a question based on your statement.
Yeah, that is why I'm also referring you to the utterance made by this man. Nobody is talking about this one. We are talking. I don't have any right, being a police officer, to use any obscene languages against anybody. I would have also want or love the media houses to condemn this one as well, before going further to cascade things that are not real, that are fake. That's my concern here.
This is the statement. Unfortunately, some individuals take pleasure in portraying the country negatively
creating the false impression that it is unsafe and unstable. However, those who contribute to the negative image, please listen. However, those who contribute to the negative image of Sierra Leone on a global scale will ultimately be held accountable, as affirmed by the prayers of Governor Clarkson. Some people are saying this is a threat to journalists or media who do not kowtow to what the police are saying. What do you say to that?
Do you consider the prayer of Governor Clarkson as a threat? It was a prayer meant for Sierra Leoneans. So is it a threat? Is it a threat? Then maybe we have to bring Governor Clarkson to book.
Bob Sinsenu is the deputy spokesperson for the Sierra Leone Police. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. Drought and flood linked to higher than normal temperatures claimed the lives of thousands of people and displaced millions across Africa in 2024. The United Nations warns that extreme weather remains one of the main risks facing Africa in 2025, with multiple disasters likely to occur. For VOA, Darren Taylor reports.
The United Nations says North Africa, West Africa, and Southern Africa are especially vulnerable to temperature increases of between 1.5 and 3 degrees Celsius in the near future. Some of the places most at risk, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says, are the entire Sahel region, the Horn of Africa, Mozambique, Nigeria, and South Sudan. University of Cape Town climate scientist Peter Johnston tells VOA that 2025 is going to be a rough year in Africa.
More extreme heat, very, very definitely. But there's a lot of opportunity for more extreme cold. These massive systems are affected by the movement of heat. And when, for example, when the ice melts in the Antarctic, that ice goes into the water and in fact makes the water colder, which makes the air colder in some parts of the world. And that cold air then moves to places and people say, wow, this is so cold. What's happened to global warming? When it is in fact global warming that is causing these changes. So in a nutshell, global warming is going to cause our weather to be more extreme. So expect more flooding, expect more cold, and certainly expect more extreme heat, more very hot days.
The head of the African Climate Policy Center at the United Nations, James Murumbedzi, describes the continent's climate crisis as multidimensional.
So we have an increase in extreme weather events, but you also have an increase and intensification in slow onset climate-related events, such as biodiversity loss, such as land degradation, which all have significant impacts, including, for instance, forcing people off of the land, forcing people into migration, which have negative impacts on infrastructure, which have negative impacts on health and a whole range of issues. Africa certainly is more impacted than other continents, particularly because the continent has limited capacity to adapt to the impacts of our climate change.
Delegations at the UN Climate Summit in Azerbaijan in November agreed that wealthier countries will triple climate financing to developing countries to $300 billion annually, but not until 2035. Murumbedzi tells VOA it's too little, too late. In 2025 and beyond, he says, African countries will use big parts of domestic budgets to finance climate adaptation, forcing them to take loans that increase their debt. Murumbedzi says Africa's mineral wealth should be used to finance construction of climate-resilient infrastructure.
So you have huge deposits of copper, lithium, cobalt, all of the critical materials, battery materials that are required to support renewable energy. But for these to actually constitute viable sources of resources for climate action, we also need to see changes in the relations of production, the relations of extraction of those minerals, so that the benefits are flowing to the continent. The current relations of Africa with the rest of the world is that actually Africa is a source of raw materials, including raw minerals that are extracted, exported. So what would benefit the continent is if the financing system were to be reformed in order to allow for investment in building infrastructure, capacities, technologies for the continent to process these raw materials and to trade with the rest of the world on equal terms.
But so far, he says, there's no sign of that happening, with richer countries buying and using Africa's minerals to develop their own measures to protect them against climate change. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Volunteers and supporters connected to former President Jimmy Carter's philanthropic efforts in his long post-presidency mourned his passing a week ago at age 100. VOA's Kane Farabaugh has more.
Suzanne Taylor from Buffalo, New York, admits she isn't handy.
Really, I have no building skills. I'm terrified of flying.
But when she went online to donate money to help Habitat for Humanity's recovery efforts after the 2005 Kashmir earthquake in Pakistan, something caught her attention.
And the banner ad said, now accepting applications for the what was then Jimmy Carter Work Project in India. And it struck me like a bolt of lightning that that was what I was supposed to do next.
Taylor volunteered with Habitat for Humanity to build houses alongside Jimmy Carter in India in 2006. She participated in a dozen more building projects hosted by the former president and his wife, Rosalind, around the globe.
So when you ask me if it's because of the Carters, that is the only reason I got involved.
The Carters spent a week each year building houses for Habitat for Humanity. The other 51 weeks were spent in the service of their nonprofit Carter Center, which fights disease, builds hope, and wages peace throughout the world. Something Chris Jones of Portland, Oregon, didn't know when he was looking for an organization to donate money to. Jones and his wife Barb were impressed by the center's financial management.
Turns out, I didn't know this at the time, but Jimmy Carter's quite the penny pincher, and he kept a close eye on how funds were spent.
Jones not only sent money to the Carter Center over the years, but also participated in one of its key democracy programs, election monitoring.
There was the Tunisian Arab Spring elections in 2014, and I got the call saying, hey, can you be in Tunisia in the next couple weeks for this mission? And I jumped at the chance.
Jones later joined the center's election monitoring mission in Liberia in 2017. He's grateful that the Carter's global humanitarian work offered him an opportunity that transcended financial support. He says his election monitoring work was transformative.
Monitoring polling stations, watching the counting of ballots really gave me an appreciation of how the democratic process works in these countries.
Jones says Jimmy Carter would welcome being remembered more for what he did beyond his years in the White House.
But I think his proudest accomplishment was the Carter Center. I really want the world to remember how transformative he was and how much good he's accomplished.
Suzanne Taylor plans to continue volunteering with Habitat for Humanity and the Carter Center. She says among the greatest tributes to the Carters are the many supporters participating today and in the future who have never met either Jimmy or Rosalind Carter in person.
There are new people who are coming on board as donors and followers and builders.
The Carter Center has monitored more than 100 elections and continues to fight neglected tropical diseases globally. The parasitic guinea worm, which once infected more than 3.5 million people, is down to fewer than 20 cases. The complete eradication of the disease was one of Jimmy Carter's signature efforts with the Carter Center. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Chicago.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from African Collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Today we review the most consequential stage of the dwindling impact of the Glass of Berlin. We look particularly at the conferences that were called during the war, Second World War, which this time was really a world war. Battles were fought in North Africa, they were fought in Asia, Burma, and they were fought in the Pacific as well as in Japan. So it was truly an explosive event in world history. And as the war seems to be moving in the direction of the Allied powers, in 1944, eminent British economists and American economists met in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, to determine what factors caused the breakdown of the economic system in the 1930s that caused high unemployment, high inflation, and misery for many in the world. They decided, after long discussions and meetings, that they should establish two new institutions. One was the International Monetary Fund and the Development Agency, which we call the World Bank. They also decided that the European nations will be responsible for selecting the leadership of the IMF invitation, and the World Bank will be selected by the government of the United States. Then, as we arrived in 1945, the waning stage of the Second World War, diplomats, ministers, experts met in Bretton Woods, again in the United States. You could see the shift in the balance of power. In previous decades, whenever there's an attempt to restore world order after a conflict, all were held in Europe. But there was a rising power in North America, and they recognized the Dunn-Bretton Oaks Conference. Try to look at why the League of Nations collapsed, which led to the Second World War. They identified three main problems. The first was that the system of League of Nations was rejected by the United States Senate. So the United States did not participate in the League of Nations. And many believe the absence of the United States weakened that project. They also noted that the creation of the new system of international civil servants, which had been established under the League, was eroding. And they blame this on the fact that the inspiring first Secretary General of the League of Nations, Sir Eric Drummond, had left the League in 1933 to become the envoy of Britain to Rome. So they wanted to find an answer. And then the third thing they looked at is, why did those countries which were giving the authority to manage colonies from the defeating part in the First World War were not managing it properly. With respect to the first concern, President Roosevelt particularly paid attention that they should be members of the new world order called the United Nations. They also tried to look at the security arrangements under the League, under which every member state had a veto. For the new world order, they said it would be only few states that will have the veto power. In the Dunn-Bretton Oaks proposal, they had this envisaged only three permanent Security Council members with veto: United Kingdom, France, the United Kingdom, United States, and Russia, Soviet Union. But at a meeting in the Crimea, the conferees at that time, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, were faced with a complaint by General de Gaulle in London, who did not agree that they should leave France out of the permanent members. So they agreed in that conference to bring in France as a permanent member, and Roosevelt in turn said China should also be brought in. That is how we arrived at the five permanent members, which were supposed to be the policemen of the world. Then as it comes to the question of this management of the authority given to, they decided that they will change the mandate system in the League to a trusteeship to make sure that those powers who have been given the authority to manage it will know this is a trust, it is not their territory. And during the negotiations in San Francisco, because these proposals, the Dunn-Bretton Oaks proposals, were forwarded to all those states that were invited to the San Francisco conference. In the first place, this was supposed to be a conference of peace-loving states. In fact, if you look at the United Nations Charter, you will see that one qualification to become a member that you must be a peace-loving state. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure that I present to you the
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Plenty to go around, so girl, make you dance when you hear this sound. Now we the puppy all over town. So tell me if you dey down, dey down. Do you know, say you want me to go like oh. Girl, I know, some things that you do not know. Whether na traffic I be go slow, baby, I promise I go still show. Spending money, Pablo. Yeah. I suppose she look. But I go by Belgium. My money na alele, my pressure. But it's like she my balaba, put on for high tension. But you must apply your tea, big boy, you must buy plenty. Mismanage my funds on you, all I really wanna do is
mismanage my funds. You ain't wanna stop me.
Mismanage my funds on you.
Then bro got off for the voltage. Tilapia, Cote, bring a goofy with the cocaine. Gobe, you see the bed, do not replay. Find a bachelor for my brose. Conquer the streets with the play.
I need your billing up, buddy. All got the woman. If I handle this, your body, all got so poso, all got so poso. If you put me for palava, Jabolo, if I like, what can they make? What be fair, they go to bed.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of The Voice of America in Washington.
Together, the love daylight's supposed to be.
Together. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, don't use another man's time to set your clock. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.
We the conquered, my lovers, the sunset. I'll be buying you Prada bags and more. Honey, you making sweet macara and cocoa. We for shop some